And I really enjoyed his talk when he spoke. And after the meeting was over with, I went up and I gave him a big hug. And I said, it's the first time I ever really wanted to hug a warden's neck, you know. Because I come from those places you just didn't associate with the warden. So, but, only on certain terms, you know. But our speaker tonight is Tom. And I'll turn the meeting over to Tom.
Thanks very much, folks. It was nice seeing you. Being a drinking man, I need something to drink. I ought to quit this stuff. I swear to God, I've been to the bathroom 3 times since 7:30, and I have the distinct feeling that I used to have when they were running me out of a bar, that I liked one more time being just right. I'm Tom Ivester, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's great to see you. It's great to see you. My home group is a big book group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Southern Pines, North Carolina. My sobriety date is February 2nd, 1957. And I'm deeply grateful for that, deeply grateful. And grateful for the privilege and pleasure, really, of being here and being back in Florida. And seeing a lot of old friends and a bunch of new friends. I even met a couple of people from Florida here. I don't know how they got in. Everybody else is like Lou from Boston or Canada or somewhere. And it really is great to see you guys. That kind of reminded me about the thing of going to the bathroom. A fellow came into the program and he'd been sober about 3 months. And his wife had gotten very actively involved in Al-Anon. And he went to a Saturday night speaker meeting one night, and on the way home, his wife was just bouncing and said, "Wasn't that the finest speaker you ever heard in your life? Boy, wasn't that great?" And he said, "Well, it's about like all the others, you know." They got home, and she was still raving, and he was still playing it down. And he said, "You know, I've been thinking about this thing. I don't know if I'm getting so much out of this AA deal after all." Said that before I got here, all I did was drink beer and go to the bathroom. Said, "Now I'm here, and all I do is drink coffee and go to the bathroom." She said, "Yeah, but there's a big difference. Now you get out of bed to go to the bathroom." Really is a good conference and a great facility. Like the other said, really nice. And it's really super to be in nice places. You know, it sure beats the boxcar. But I have mixed feelings about it sometimes. You know, I really hope that we never get the program so nice that it gets out of touch with drunks. You know, that, yeah, like there's a guy in my group. I had the unpopular job, unpopular with the group, not with me, last month of making coffee. And I swear to God, that's one thing I can't learn, but I am very tenacious with the thing. I don't give up. And a guy came up to me one night that I knew when he came in, and he said, "Don't you have decaf?" And I said, "You sorry devil. My God, 18 months ago, you were drinking that muscatel that Bill was talking about that ain't never seen a grape. Squeezing sterno through a sock. Now, don't you have decaf?" Oh, we get well in a hurry. Oh, God, we get really has been nice. This is a good conference. You guys, I really want to commend the folks who put it together. It's a well-run conference. You could tell the difference when you walk in. And folks have really been nice. Really have. They've been nice to most all the speakers that are here this weekend. With Larry, my buddy from Louisville, was taken out for a ride in a stretch limousine, I think, to see Tampa today. And they let me go out to see Tampa today, walking in the rain. Feel right at home, my God. Has been nice. It's been a good program. What a delight it was to hear Bill. Those of you who missed the speaker last night, missed what for me is one of the sweetest things in this program is hearing somebody share the rich history of this program in his own life, and what a treat that was. And then the other folks, old buddies at Ida this morning, and Jim, and Woody with the big book. And I'm looking forward to some more buddies that we're going to hear. And it will wrap up on Monday with CD. And if you ain't experienced CD, don't get tied up Monday. I guarantee you that's an event in itself, just to experience CD. So I'm glad to be here. Now I'm going to share my story a little bit like decaf coffee, I guess. You won't need to take any copious notes on this sermon tonight, I guarantee you that. Probably will not give you a headache. Probably won't challenge you with any bold new thoughts or climb new mountains. Probably not going to leave here an ounce smarter than you came in if I do it like I want to. Because what I am is just an old-fashioned, fundamental, big book drunk. That's who I am. And that's what I want to share with you from that perspective. I don't want to get into a whole lot of stuff and a philosophy and preaching and teaching. I just basically want to share with you as much as I can. I got a lot of stuff I'd like to share with you. I'd like to tell you a gruesome drunkalogue. God, I'd love to do that. I love drunkalogues, especially mine. I just really love mine. I'd love to tell you all about that. I'll tell you a little bit about it, but I won't tell much. And then I'd really like to relive all of the last 32 years and share some of the experiences that have come my way in this marvelous program. But I can't do all that either. I want to share with you as much as I can about that sort of thing. And just basically let you know once again that this program can in fact work for hopeless drunks, and it can in fact give a brand new, beautiful, clean way of life to a hopeless case. And that's essentially what I want to do. Yeah, I'm like every other drunk I've ever seen. It's an interesting thing to me. When I first came into the program, I didn't identify with anybody. And now I identify with everybody. I rarely, if ever, hear an alcoholic tell his story that I don't identify, because it seemed like when we get past what we did and start hearing what we were, how we were, all the differences that exist go out of the window. And we find that we are remarkably similar people, whoever we might be. And we are a really mixed bag, if you've ever seen it. Wouldn't it be something if we all truly knew each other in this room tonight? Holy cow. Now, AA has got to be the most remarkable phenomenon that's ever been, because by any standard, we ought not to ever be able to conduct a meeting in peace and harmony. It just ought to be impossible. When you think of who we are, and I won't dwell on it because it makes you nervous. You know, that in this room, my God, we got some of everything. We got some folks in here smart as a bull, and we got some really smart people. More letters behind their name than they got in it. Highly educated people. And we have people in this room totally illiterate. We have people in here of every political persuasion known to man, I imagine. Religions. My God, every major war has been over religion. And we've got every religion represented in here, no doubt. And none. We've got very wealthy people in here. That fellow with that Volkswagen Jetta. God knows. That's a fancy, don't even need a driver. You know, we got... And we got slam poor folks in here. We got people here that speak a different language. You know, I'm not sure what Gus speaks. Well, God, on and on, different colors. Yeah, we got different shades of color here, all kinds of stuff. We got rednecks. We got we had the most fascinating dinner conversation. I met the co-chair, Ken, and I am proud to announce to you that boy has never been north of the Mason-Dixon line. And he'll tell you about it in a heartbeat. We got a gal here named Madeline. I want you to meet her. Madeline, if you don't know Madeline, I want you to know people go to great sacrifice to get to these meetings. This girl runs a poker game of some repute in Tampa, Florida. And tonight she closed down her poker game to be here for this meeting. All kind of folk in here. Yeah, and you would think with all that, it'd be a mess. And you know what you add to that? Ain't nobody in charge. Nobody. No. Oh, God. Ken thought he was, but he... Nobody in charge. By any standard, we ought to have a major riot any time. Yeah, so... And then you add that, and I'm one of them. Yeah, so it really is a remarkable thing to me. So now I find that I have something in common with everybody else. I guess I could oversimplify and say I became an alcoholic, drank too much too long, but that is oversimplifying to me. I think I was basically a guy who was destined to be some kind of a problem, and all it took was adding booze to me, because I was a guy who was born, I don't like to admit it, but I was born in South Carolina. Gee, that's a horrible start in life. And during the Depression, that old scratching out of living in that dirt farm and bootlegging, and good God, even before I knew the whole world didn't look like that, I knew there had to be something different than that, and I didn't like it. So as far back as I can remember, I've always had that nagging sense of restlessness and discontent, that sense of being ill at ease, out of place. I didn't like anything about who I was, where I was, how I felt, nothing about it. And my ambition in life was to change it at every opportunity. And when I discovered booze, it was no mystery to me then or now why it was an instant love affair, because it did more for me than anything ever could. And I found in booze the best friend I ever had in my life. And it stayed that way. I never once went to booze that I didn't get exactly what I needed. Now, in the latter days, I got a lot more than I wanted. But I always got what I needed. It gave me what I needed. It rounded out the corners, smoothed over the rough places, filled in the holes, and it gave me that sense of comfort and well-being that was to be so important to me. And where, bless you, child. Now, that was a sneeze. That was a And it gave. I'd have been stupid not to drink. Yeah, I don't wonder about that. With me, that period of drinking lasted just a short while. I started serious drinking when I was about 16, and I drank in my 16th, 17th, into my 18th years, basically as what I can only describe as a problem drinker. I drank to solve the problems of my life. Did it very effectively. Do not believe I was an alcoholic. I think I might have been in some formative stage. I think I had some of the emotional makeup, some of the personality characteristics, but I don't really believe I was an alcoholic. I believed then and now that I could have stopped drinking. I have no doubt that I could have stopped drinking had I wanted. But in my 18th year, that was to change. And I crossed that line from problem drinking to alcoholism, and I experienced what I fully believe is that those of us who cross that line from alcoholism or from other kinds of drinking to alcoholism step aside from every other drinker in the world, and we are no longer like other drinkers. I believe that. And even though I didn't know it, the fact of the business was that I was to never be the same. I was to never be the same. In the sense that if I took one drink, of anything with alcohol in it, I would get drunk. And even though it's been more than 32 years, my last drink was actually November the 19th, 1956. I believe fully that if I took a drink in Tampa, Florida tonight, I would not be sober in North Carolina. I doubt that I would get back. I don't know how much staying power I'd have after all these years. Probably not much. I believe that's what happened to me when I crossed that line. Now, I don't fully understand exactly what happened. But my life changed and was to never be the same. And from that point on, I was to never drink without an absolute predictable kind of outcome. If I took a drink, I got drunk. And I tried everything from VO to Vitalis hair tonic. I even tried hydraulic brake fluid one time. Didn't mean to. Some enterprising drunk Yankee, I'm sure. Sold me some of that stuff, and I drank it, and I swear it was effective. Now, I don't know if it gets you drunk, but, brother, it'll lock me tight. Good God. Whatever it was, it didn't make any difference. If I took it and it changed my mood, then I'd go get more. And I didn't realize that. And from that point forward, you know, my life really was to never be the same. And you know, I believe I haven't had a drink since then. If God knows I've come close. I hadn't had a drink since I got in the program, but I've come close. But I fully believe that if I took one drink, it would be the same old thing. And then from that point on, my story was like every other alcoholics I've ever met. Now, the events might have been different. There might have been things happened to me that didn't happen to you. I might have gotten jailed in a different place or threw up a different color. It doesn't really make much difference. It was the same story. And it was basically just a futile battle of quiet desperation. Now, I didn't rationalize that or think it out or dwell on it at the time. I was so busy doing it that I rarely, if ever, stopped and gave serious thought to what was going on. Oh, I'd give serious thought when I was throwing up my toenails or something like that. But it was momentary at best. And I never really analyzed much what was happening. I was just caught up in doing it. And it was that sort of hopeless, I guess subtle awareness that my life was coming apart. I simply could not deal with my life the way I wanted to be. And I went through all the rationalizing and adjusting. And if I had to characterize what my life was like, it was basically an endless series of failures and new starts. Failures and new starts. And each time I failed and started over, settled for a little less, and a little less, and a little less. Until finally I wound up, 8 years after I started serious drinking, living a kind of life that I could not have imagined living. Could not have imagined living. Yeah, I was a guy that was born to poor but very good and decent parents. And they didn't raise me to live the way that I wound up living. But by the time I was 24 years old, the last year that I drank, I lived on the streets. I used to say that I lived by my wits, but that isn't exactly true. I lived by my lack of character. I don't know of anything that a man can do that I haven't done. And I'm not proud of that by any stretch of the imagination. But I pray God that I never get so arrogant in my sobriety that I am unwilling to admit it, or even more, maybe more importantly, am unwilling to share it. Don't know of anything that a man can do. I lived on the streets, scuffle, shuffle, hustle, survived any way that I could. My most frequent address was a place called the Rialto Theater. And it wasn't because I liked movies. It just happened to be the cheapest room in Flint, Michigan. You could go in for 35 cents and get in out of the cold. I wasn't born to live like that. But that's where my kind hung out. And I wasn't born to drink that Muscatel that Bill was talking about in an alley with a bunch of strange-looking characters, but that's where my kind went, and so that's where I went. I wasn't born to do that sort of thing, but it became what at one time would have been unthinkable, became remarkably normal and comfortable for me to do. Yeah, I wasn't born to eat in greasy spoon restaurants, nor in soup kitchens and that sort of thing, but that's where my kind went to survive. I wasn't born to that. I wasn't born to sell my life's blood at $5 a whack every time I could get them to buy it. But that's what my kind did to survive. And so, when I look at that, now God only knows, I could not have imagined my life ever coming to such an end in any number of years. But in 8 short years, that's exactly what happened to me. You know, I look back on a life that was absolutely characterized by nothing but that kind of dirt and squalor and embarrassment and shameful conditions, an endless series of jitter joints and jails and God only knows what. I believed that I would drink myself to death. Now, I had that sort of morbid thoughts. I never gave much thought to solving it, but I believed that I would have drunk myself to death, and I believe today that I would have done that had I been left unattended. I just believed that I was the kind of guy that was destined to do that. But I was brought to an end with a series of events that some of you are well aware of. Things that I can't look back on and say, well, I'm grateful for everything that brought me here. But you know, I wound up being brought to a stop in a very tragic way, not in terms of what happened to me, but in terms of what I did. And what I wound up doing was the kind of thing that I guess every alcoholic in the world fears doing. I've never talked to an alcoholic or the family members of an alcoholic who hasn't had the pronounced fear that somehow or other in a drunken mess they'll wind up going out and doing irreparable damage to other people. And we've all gone through those horror stories of waking up and wondering what we've done and going out to look at the car to see if there's blood on it. And thank God, for most, it's just a bad dream, and it never happens. But I'm here to tell you that for some, it's a very real nightmare, and I was one of those. Yeah, I was a guy who went to jail with great frequency, and one morning in Flint, Michigan, I woke up in jail that I was a regular customer, took it for granted that I was in there for the same thing I was always in there for. Drunk or thrown out of a place or fighting or whatever, and took it for granted. It was the same thing. And after I was awake a little while, the jailer came by, a guy I knew well, asked him when I could get out, and he said, I hope never, and walked off. And I didn't know what the man was talking about. And then a little later, some of the other fellows in there told me that the night before, I'd been driving somebody's car down the main street of that city and had run down and killed 2 people. And my reaction was like anybody's would be. I get just shock and disbelief. I simply could not deal with it. I couldn't handle it. And couldn't believe it. Couldn't accept it. And I was like a man in a catatonic state. I just backed off and just refused to deal with that. And then gradually accepted the fact that indeed I had done more damage than any drunk ever ought to be allowed to do. And it's a matter then, how do you balance the scales between a street drunk and 2 people with their lives in front of them, nice young kids? Well, obviously you don't. It's the only time I'd ever been in jail. I didn't try to get out. I didn't want out. I didn't tell anybody who I was or where I was from. They knew who I was, but they didn't know where I was from. And then somebody found out about my folks in North Carolina and contacted them. My mother made what was to be her last trip to anybody's jail to get her little boy out. It wasn't her first one. She'd been to many, but it was to be her last one. That dear lady died about 3 years ago, and I think among my many prayers of thanksgiving is the fact that when she died, it was with deep appreciation for a program that had given her a son for 29 years instead of a drunken embarrassment. If I never got another thing out of this program, that would be worth everything I've ever done 10 times over. I didn't know how to tell her that I was afraid to get out of jail. I didn't know how to tell her anything. And so she got an attorney, and they negotiated for me to be released on bond. I was charged with manslaughter, and I was released after 76 days. Now, I'd done a lot of thinking. You know that. And I knew that I would never take another drink. I just didn't think that I could. It seemed to me it would be physically impossible to pick up a drink. The guilt was too great. I stayed sober a day and a half. First day I was out, I just walked the streets. I could not stand to be by myself or with anybody else. Just couldn't say anything about it. And then after the second day, about a half a day, I started to drink, of course. And between July and November of 1956, I drank like nobody I've ever seen. I've worked with lots of drunks. I have worked with thousands of drunks over the years. I have never worked with one like me. Never have. And I don't mean I was the world's worst two-fisted drinker. I don't mean that. I was a pathological drinker. I was a guy that was obviously trying to drink himself to death. I think I always was. But I was clearly trying to do that at that point. There was no question in my mind. Many times I could remember the clear thought when just before I would go under, thinking, God, I hope I don't wake up this time. It always did. And there I was. So I really believe it's a miracle for me to be here sober tonight. And, well, obviously that didn't happen. In November the 19th of 1956, I had what I hope and pray was my last drink. Didn't know it would be at the time, but I finished off a little piece of a bottle of gin, about that much, went off to court. Now, it was not a trial in the usual sense of presenting a defense. I couldn't even tell them what I'd done. They had to tell me. I was obviously found guilty. And sentenced that day to 5 to 15 years in state prison, Southern Michigan. I knew what that meant. You know, when you're a street character, you know that going to jail is an occupational hazard. It just happens. But going to a penitentiary was a different thing. And I remember that as clearly as if it were today. When I got past the sentence, I had an instinctive, I guess, very normal reaction of fear. Because even though I'd been in jails all over the place, I'd never been to a penitentiary. And I had an instinctive reaction of fear. But almost simultaneously, the most real sense of relief I'd ever known. Because I knew it was done. There wouldn't be any more. And the next day, I walked into Jackson Prison in Jackson, Michigan, the largest walled institution in the world. And in my somewhat educated opinion, I fully believe it is, if not the worst, the second worst penitentiary in the United States. And I walked in. I wasn't really eaten with fear or that sort of thing. I was a young fella devoid of feeling. I just had no feeling left other than just enormous guilt and shame for even being alive. And I knew I would never come out of that place alive. And honest to God, did not care. I truly did not care. Mighty sick young man. Put me in a cell. I didn't speak to anybody for the first 30 days. I just had nothing to say. I'd sit in that cell and read anything to keep from thinking, count bricks, and I could read a matchbook cover for an hour. Yeah, if somebody wanted me, they came, got me, they'd ask me their questions. I'd tell them my lies, I'm sure. And little did I know that rather than being the end, that was to be the land of beginning again. A brand new start, and I had no earthly idea that it could or would happen. I was called out one day by a little social worker. A little guy, must have been the only job he could get because he didn't like it much and didn't stay long. But I'm thankful for him. He had just got out of school, and he was a typical little social worker. I don't mean any offense by that, but he was just a little old pudgy, pink-cheeked guy and probably knew nothing about alcoholism. If he'd have come in that prison, somebody would have bought him the first day. I think he'd have. Now, I'd been reviewed by lots of people. I'd been diagnosed by lots of people. It's always the same diagnosis. My God, you're an awful drunk. And usually, people would always tell me I ought to quit. This guy, same routine, asked me a bunch of questions. He said, you sure had a lot of trouble with drinking. And then he did something I had never experienced before. Probably the least knowledgeable guy I'd ever talked to. He said, we have an AA group here at the institution. I think you better go. It was exactly the way he put it. It wasn't an order, nor certainly an invitation. It was just a flat declarative statement. We have a group. Think you better go. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. I don't know if we talked anymore. He couldn't have described it anyway. Yeah, but you sometimes think there's some magic to helping a drunk. My God, all it took for me was to find one human being who said, that away, boy. And I've never looked back. Never looked back. Yeah. So I didn't know what it was. My image of Alcoholics Anonymous was not great. You know, I thought it was going to be a sad thing. I could just see this bunch of worn-out old drunks sitting around in a dim room commiserating with each other. And I didn't particularly want to go. I wanted to sit in the cell and stare at my navel, you know, whatever you do when you're in full retreat. It's what I wanted to do. And I didn't want to get out and mingle with a bunch of swingers like that. But I walked in my first day meeting, Groundhog Day, 1957. Didn't know what to expect. And whatever I had expected, it could not have lived up to the experience, that's for sure. I sat and listened to the first alcoholic I ever heard tell his story. And I swear to God, that I don't know how you reacted to your first, but that shocked me. To hear that man, you know, sitting back from a distance, he wasn't a bad-looking guy. He had on his obligatory blue preaching suit and wasn't a bad-looking guy. Unless you got real close. He could not stand close examination. He was an ex-everything. He had been everything in the world, and a gangster and some of everything And he'd been sober 15 years. He was an ex-professional boxer, and apparently a very poor one, because he was a beat-up little old dude. But he told his story. He told that story of alcoholism and recovery, and I thought, my God, that's got to be the craziest man I ever said. Why would he do that? Yeah, why would a fine-looking citizen like that come in here to a bunch of raunchy convicts and tell that kind of mess? Or to anybody? Yeah, it made no sense to me at all. But I kept going back. And I don't know, I do know, I think, what brought me back to second meeting. It certainly was not any identification. He was not like me. He was an entirely different kind of man. He was not that. But I think the one thing that brought me back was not the experience of the man, it was the spirit of the man. The spirit of the man. Because he was the first guy I had ever seen in my life who talked about not drinking, who made it sound good. Everybody I'd ever seen who didn't drink looked like they didn't drink. You know what I mean? Holy cow. I always thought sober was about a first cousin to rigor mortis, you know, that most boring condition. And I never wanted to be sober in my life. I never did. I didn't want to be drunk either. You know, I wanted to be about halfway in that marvelous place that I sometimes got. But I think it was the spirit. I think that I could not have told anybody why I went back, but I think it was just the recognition that this was a guy like me who wouldn't like me anymore, and I could not have said that. But I think that's what brought me back. It was the spirit of seeing that maybe, just maybe, there was something there for me. And so I went back. I was not an instant convert in this program. I'm always leery of instant converts. That it just doesn't seem to, I just don't get real excited about instant converts. I was anything but. I was uncomfortable in AA. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I was 24 years old. I didn't think anybody could be an alcoholic at 24. I was the youngest guy in the group by a few years. I just couldn't believe that I was. I said I was, because I hated to be the only guy out of 300 members that wasn't. So I'd say it, you know, but it didn't mean a thing. I couldn't pronounce it well, Gus. So I just say it, you know, but it didn't mean anything. But I kept going back. Yeah, and many, many times. I can't help but wonder why this thing worked for me. And I don't beat myself up about it, but I can't help but wonder why. What made the difference with me? Because, you know, the fact of the business is that not everybody who comes into Alcoholics Anonymous gets sober. They may get sober, but many don't stay sober for whatever reason. You know, the fact seems to be that based on 54 years of experience, those of us sitting in here tonight, and normally the people you see at a conference are people who are really getting eagerly involved in the program. But 54 years of experience tells us that about half of us won't make it. Now, there'll be another Tampa Bay Roundup next year. But the fact is, about half of us probably won't be here. And we don't know which ones are which, do we? I don't know what made the thing work for me, as opposed to the other guys. You know, because I sat in meetings with guys who looked to me like they were so desperately wanting this thing to work. And I look at a rather alarming statistic. Out of the 300 members who were in that group, there are two that I know of who are solidly sober in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And lest you think, if you've got any years in the program, lest you think that's an alarming statistic about prisons, think back to the group that you got introduced in. And you may find the same sort of chilling awareness that those of us who were able to get in here and grab this elusive brass ring and hang on to it and ride it into a new way of life, God only knows how lucky we are. I believe that. It gives me sort of a fundamental hard-nosed attitude about the thing. I don't mess around with sobriety. I don't mess around with the facts of what this program requires of me. And I'll tell you, working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is the toughest job I've ever done in my life. And it's gotten easier over the years, but it's the toughest job I've ever undertaken. because a screwed up character like me wasn't going to get well real easy. And why? And I, by the way, out of those two that are sober in AA, only one has been sober since his first meeting. You know which one. Let me tell you something you may not know. If there wasn't going to be but one, I believe they got the right one. I really do. Now, that probably ain't real nice to say, is it? I couldn't care less whether it's nice to say. You know, I'm not like a guy. It's part of my hard-nosed orientation, I guess. I'm not like a dear friend of mine, and God knows he is a good friend of mine. I heard him say one night at a meeting, I know it was figuratively said, but nonetheless, he said, if one of us has to drink again, me or you, the group, if one of us has to drink again, I hope it's me instead of you. I swear to God, y'all the finest looking bunch of reform Yankees I have ever seen in my life. But if you ever hear me say anything that even rhymes with that, please kick my fanny real hard for me, and I'll be ever grateful. I'm the only guy in this room or in this world who knows how I feel about being sober. I'm the only guy in this world who knows how I felt about crying my eyes out and being brokenhearted and so utterly ashamed of who I was. Nobody could possibly know how important this is to me, as I couldn't to you. So wouldn't I be kind of silly to put your sobriety above mine? I believe that this is a tough kind of thing to do. And it's about getting well from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body. And I believe it takes a very tough commitment. I don't believe panty waists get well. I just don't. I've been to an awful lot of funerals in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the people that I've seen who've been able to stay well are folks who've got some backbone, who developed some courage, who truly want a new way of life and are willing to do the things that it takes. So I'm not real generous about saying, geez, I'm just so brokenhearted about these other fellows. I wish some of them could have made it and I could have done their time. Now, I didn't always feel that way. You know, I was just a guy following a crowd. I was just a guy, just a face in the crowd. And I didn't have any strong desire to stay sober. I wasn't even sure why I was there. And many times when I think back to what made the difference, you know, what I like to remember, you know, I worry sometimes about the drifts that I see in the program. Yeah, one of the things that I say, and I'm not a prophet of gloom, but I'm not a Pollyanna either. And I'm not somebody who is just absolutely sure that our future is solid. I'm a guy that has some concerns about Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, I'm concerned about it, and I think it's part of my responsibility to take care, just like Bill laid out last night, the rich legacy of how this unbelievable thing called Alcoholics Anonymous shaped up and has touched well over a million people's lives. You mentioned about John of Massachusetts who died. And a whole bunch of our Johns around this country are leaving. And you know who they leave it with, don't you? Me and you. Me and you. And I think it's our responsibility to hang on to those things that distinguish this program. And there are enormous pressures. And I see changes happening in Alcoholics Anonymous that are worrisome to me. I swear to God, amen, I don't want to end this thing called life or my activity in the program, which is going to be one and the same. But I honestly don't envy people who are coming into the program today. I really don't. Because one of the things that I've seen us do is drift towards some strong, almost single reliance on meetings. As if meetings were the magic. As if meetings was where it happens. As if revival meetings is what's going to get us well. Meetings are big. I know regular meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous as big as this. I could not conceive of getting sober in this. This is celebration. This is a time for fellowship and reunion and unity with other people. It's not about confronting thing and looking somebody in the eye and dealing with tough realities. And I don't envy people who come in today. And I see some drifts that one that's particularly concerned to me is a thing that I can only call a drift toward me and my program is the only way I know to describe it. And I think it grows out of the proliferation of treatment things around the country. Let me make a mixed message type of statement. Now, I'm a guy, I am not anti-treatment. I am a guy who is deeply grateful for the fact that alcoholics today can get treatment almost on demand, in many cases even without money, anywhere in the United States of America. And I'm deeply grateful for that. I don't mean to minimize that. And I'm grateful for the fact that it's dignified treatment, where we treat it in places like this setting, where people can actually get well and be treated like genuinely sick people. I'm grateful for that. And yet, at the same time, I worry about it because there's such a gap between where treatment centers tend to effectively work and the linkage into Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I see as I go around the country are people who are backed off sniping at each other instead of trying to find a middle ground of working. And one of the things that I see happening that's a concern of mine, and I can only think that it came out of the treatment movement, is that me and my program business, where we look at the program almost like an individual thing, like it's a one against the world type of thing. It's me and my program, me and my steps, me and my counselor. And I'd like to suggest to you fellow alcoholics, this ain't a me program. It's a we program. And the day that I put my own sobriety selfishly above that of our collective welfare, I think I'm in trouble. I think I'm in trouble. Yeah, I think that sort of thinking, that sort of isolationist thing, in my candid opinion, is nothing more than a perpetuation of the self-centered condition that was the core of my dilemma and seems to be for many of us. I think it's a continuation of that. So I worry about some of those, and I don't envy folk who come in now. I pray God that we can find ways to more effectively provide the kinds of things that seem to get us well. Because we see lots of people coming into Alcoholics Anonymous now. God knows it's just phenomenal, the number of people coming in. But you know it's also phenomenal, the number going out. The number going out. And the success in this program, I think, is at an alarmingly low rate. It's one of the reasons that I try to talk sensibly and maybe toughly, and I know this is not entertaining stuff to talk about, but I'll let you in on a little secret. I ain't here to entertain. Not a lick. Not a lick. It's one of the reasons that I like to get into these kinds of issues. Like, you know, share this experience with you that... Yeah. A guy came up to me a while back. I spoke at a meeting in North Carolina down in Lumberton. And this fellow came up to me and he said, I met you last week. You spoke up at a meeting in West Virginia. And the first thing I assured him was that I didn't speak at every meeting and it would be okay to come back. And he said, but I didn't get a chance to speak to you and I wanted to tell you something. I really appreciate it. And I said, what? He said, you mentioned that you had been sober 30 years. And that you had been sober since your first meeting. And he said, I can't tell you how much that meant to me. He was a young guy. He told me a little bit about himself, that he had been in the program 11 months. He's from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he said, I was actually beginning to feel awkward because I was the only guy I knew who hadn't been out and drunk. And I felt like an oddball. I made a vow to myself then that I would never share my experience again without sharing that fact, that I've been sober ever since I got here, and so have a lot of other people. So have a lot of other people. I talked at a meeting. Ed from Charlotte was there last week, wasn't it, Ed? And I had a countdown. I spoke at this, they called it an old-time meeting. I didn't know exactly what we were going to do. But when we finished that meeting, I believe we gave out 637 and one-half years of continuous sobriety. And many of us who celebrated were people who had been sober since their first meeting. Now, I would suggest to you that there would be little argument that not only can be done, but it's the very best way to do it. The very best way to do it. To do it from the beginning and not have to do it over. Anybody like me who has had the blessing of that experience would tell you quickly. Let me tell you who would tell you even more quickly. Somebody who hasn't had that experience and has been fortunate enough but confronted with having to come back tail between legs and try again. Now, I have enormous respect for people who do that. But I don't envy them either. Yeah, I think sometimes that the best we can do in this program is just hang on. But I think it's critically important to hang on. Like I hear folks sometimes say, and again, please remind me if you ever hear me say this, if I can't be happy, I might as well be drunk. My honest opinion is the dumbest thing a drunk can say. This ain't Disneyland. You know, this is life, you know. It's life. It's not about getting giddy happy. It's about getting well. And it's a tough world. There are times when my heart breaks. I'm not happy every day. I'm happy more than I deserve to be, but I'm not happy all the time. And my sobriety is not contingent on being happy. It's contingent on knowing what I'm about, what my principles are about, and keeping my spiritual condition. Now, I'm happy more than I'm sad. But I don't want to get into that kind of thinking that if I can't be happy, then I'm a failure. Baloney. Sometimes all we can do is hang. It's like a story that I heard. A guy called his sponsor. He said, I'm in trouble. I just got laid off over at the plant. I'm broke. My wife learned about it and she's left me. And his sponsor was a good one. He said, well, don't worry about that too much. Don't drink. Pray. Go to meetings. It'll pass. Didn't think much more about it. A few days later, he got a call back. Most excited fellow you've ever seen. The guy said, man, you were right. I did what you said. I prayed, didn't drink, went to meetings. And don't you know they called me back from the plant and asked me to come back to work, gave me a promotion, and said, my loving Al-Anon wife learned about that and she's home. She's home. Great. And his sponsor said, well, don't worry about that. Don't drink. Pray. Go to meetings. It'll pass. Yes. And how true that is. You know, we don't get into some eternal state of bliss. We get to live like every other human being. And there are low spots and there are high spots. And sometimes all we can do is hang on. But for God's sakes, hang on. Hang on. And no matter what it is, it'll pass. It'll pass. So I'm sort of committed to this notion that there is a very logical, reasonable way that people get sober. It's called the steps. Heard somebody say the other day that there must be an easier, softer way. And the other guy said, yeah, there is. It leads to drinking. Yeah. So many times I wonder about what happened and why me? And I don't know that exactly. I wasn't any smarter than anybody else. I didn't particularly want to be sober in the beginning, but for some reason it worked. And when I look back at it, the only thing I can recognize is that It's like to say that everything in this program starts with a service. Everything in this program starts with a service. This conference started with a service. Somebody said drunks in Tampa Bay need a place to come together and celebrate. And it got started. And God knows how many people have jumped in and done something about it and caused it to happen. It starts with a service. Now, I've never heard anybody talk about their sobriety who didn't talk about the people involved. I've never heard anybody say, well, I got sober because I read this marvelous book and, oh, it made so much sense, and I've never heard that. I've never heard anybody say, well, this meeting was just spectacular, and that's always a real strong personal thing, and mine's no different. And when I think back, I don't know what made the difference. I can only say that what happened to me. I think the thing that made the difference for me was the people in this program. Now, I was a mighty sick young fellow. I was in this program for over a year before I could ever speak to one of the outside visitors who came to that prison. I just simply couldn't do it. I'd sit back there and inwardly cry with gratitude that somebody cared enough to come. But I could not walk up to them and say thanks. Couldn't do it. I like to think that's what I'm doing tonight and have done so many nights of my life with things that I've done, is saying thanks. But I know that that's the thing that made a difference for me, was the people. And I remember those folks who walked into my life and stuck out the right hand of fellowship and reached out to me not in spite of my condition, not in spite of my situation, but because of it. Because of it. I think one of the remarkable things about Alcoholics Anonymous, this is the only place in the world that I know where the worse your credentials, the better your welcome if you want to change. It really ennobles this program to me. And that's the way I felt as I started to come alive and experience that warm, loving thing that we call carrying the message. And I came to understand what those guys were about, and I remember them well. I remember Shy, that guy who spoke at my first meeting. The magic of his enthusiasm. What a tremendous man. He was my first sponsor, first outside sponsor, and I loved him dearly. I remember him. I remember a little Mexican fellow by the name of Gene Salazar, who used to drive from Chicago all the way to Jackson, Michigan, several times a year to carry the message. And I'd listen to that little guy tell about his life. Tell about what he did. Simple things. He called himself an all-American Irish wetback. And he married some big old Irish girl, and they had a grand life, and they'd fight and make up. And I would just vicariously go home with him when he would talk about that. It's funny what you remember, the profound things you remember. Gene always closed the talk. Not that I'm closing, I'm getting ready to, though. But Gene always closed his talk with a thing, I don't know why it stuck with me, that said, every man comes equipped with two ends, one to sit on and one to think with. Your head, your success in life largely depends on which end you use. Heads you win and tails you lose. I remember that little, and so many more. Yeah, let me tell you about one more. And then I'm going to head home. I'm going to get you out of jail here in just a minute. I remember a guy, and it's funny how the message comes, and it's not words. I don't really think words have much to do with it. I got active in the group, and I became secretary of the group. And one of my jobs was to get people to come and speak at the meeting. And that's tough to do. It's tough, you know, no matter where you get them speaking. You try to do it in a correctional institution, it's particularly difficult. And somebody told me about a guy by the name of Johnny Snow. So I wrote him a letter. I didn't know who he was writing to. I learned that Johnny Snow was an Indian fellow, totally illiterate. He could not read or write his own name. And he washed dishes in a restaurant in Lansing, Michigan. And I'd written to him, and I got the word back that he was coming. And when he came, I learned that he had gotten up at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning to make a 60-mile trip. And the reason he did it was because he didn't have a car. And he didn't have a ride. And he was going to hitchhike, and did. And just in case he didn't get rides easily, he won't have time to get there. Now, I can't tell you what Johnny Snow's speech was that day, because he didn't make a speech. But I'll tell you this, he delivered one of the most powerful messages I've ever heard. It was that kind of thing. You know, not somebody coming in there with a bunch of gobbledygook language, but somebody who had suffered through this and cared enough to reach out to another one. That's what this program's about. There are people that I used to feel sorry for in a way and just wish I could tell them differently. Were people, sometimes people would come into that institution and for some reason felt a need to, quote, talk their language, and would proceed to tell the most vile, exaggerated stories that you could imagine, with gutter language and all that kind of business. And I not only didn't feel well toward them, but I used to resent that. I used to really resent that. Because, you know, a week has 168 hours anywhere in the world. It's like Jim said, every day's got the same number, and every human's got the same number of hours. 168 hours. And my week was made up of 168 hours of the most unbelievable living conditions that a human can endure. A world where man's inhumanity to man was normal. Where sincerity was considered stupidity, where kindness was considered weakness. And I had one spot of decency in my entire week. And I, honest to God, didn't want some big-footed drunk coming in there screwing that up with a bunch of gutter language. That's what I lived in. And that's one reason I'm not a goody-two-shoes, but you don't hear much out of me. In fact, you don't hear any. And it's not because I'm a monk or because I'm a pious guy. You know, I don't want to get so good that I can't talk to a drunk. But neither do I want to stand up and try to carry this message to somebody and let them think that's what the message is. No way. No way. I don't know who's here tonight. Somebody might have brought their mother. Somebody might have brought their child. And I don't think you wanted to bring them to a waste dump. And so I think it's a part of that thing. And it was a part of that. And I was deeply grateful for those people. Some people say that you can't carry a message into a correctional institution unless you've been in one. The first man that I ever related to in my life was a man who'd probably never seen a jail. Somebody talked him into coming there, and he was the scaredest human I've ever seen. The whole time he talked, he kept looking around to see if somebody was sneaking up on him. And I could relate to that fear. And that's the thing that made the difference to me, that gave me the hope. That maybe, just maybe, there was a place for me. And I was accepted in this program, not just at face value, but at the level of what I could become. And I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in Jackson Prison. As strongly as I've ever been, I had as rich an experience in recovery and sobriety in that institution as I've ever had. And I've done just as valuable service work in that institution as I've ever done. I helped start the first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous before it even existed anywhere. And we helped start one for the guys with drug problems in there 30 years ago. Helped start a meeting in a TB sanatorium back when, a TB ward in the hospital, back when TB was a pretty contagious kind of thing and fairly common, and sat in the meeting and wore masks and conducted a meeting. Great experience, great growth. And I became a member, and this program worked as well for me there as it ever has anywhere. I became a free man, believe it or not, a free man in that institution. Well, I finally got out, and I got to wrap up because it's Gus got to get ready to dance here in just a minute. You don't have to be real smart to get out of jail. It just takes time. And I came out. I knew that I was going to stay out. I knew that. And I don't mean that in any braggadocio kind of way. I meant that I was willing to do anything it took. God knows I didn't want any more of that kind of life. And I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous was my ticket to freedom. And I went to a meeting the first night I was out, and most every night that I was out for a long, long time. And I found all the things that I wondered about and dreamed about, I found to be true in this program. I was met with a genuine warmth and acceptance that was so important to me, so important, because I really wondered if a guy like me could fit into something like this. I said, it's ridiculous to think of that now, but it wasn't then. And I remember that first meeting when I walked into with my feelings on my sleeve and how much it meant to me when somebody stuck out the right hand and said, welcome, guy, welcome. And I got immediately active. And I just want to share with you just in a rush and hurry. Sometimes I have mixed feelings about this, but I want to take just a minute, if I may, and I don't want to presume on your time, but I want to share this with you because I do have mixed feelings sometimes about sharing the grand things that have happened in my life, because I know that when there ain't much happening for you, it's kind of tough to listen to somebody else. But on the other hand, I remember how much it meant to me to listen to guys who talked about how their life came together and how there was, in fact, a new way to live and the hope it gave me. So in that interest, for anybody who might be wavering in the hope department, let me share with you just very quickly. I was active immediately in the program. And I've had some things happen to me that were unbelievable by any standard. I started immediately working in institutions. As soon as I got out, I became outside sponsor of a prison group within 2 months after I was out. And about the same period, my parole supervisor came to me one day and he said, Tom, you're real active in this AA thing, aren't you? And I said, yes, sir. And it kind of scared me because I thought he was going to tell me to slow down. I knew it wouldn't. And he said, wouldn't it help you if you could drive? And I said, yes, sir, but I can't. When I had been paroled out of Michigan, they put in letters that big, this man's never drink alcoholic beverages, this man's to never drive a motor vehicle. And I took that as a fact of life. And I said, I can't. And he said, well, let me check. A couple weeks later, I got a call, and he asked me if I could meet him up at the Sears store. And that, it so happened, that's where the license agency was in that town. And this story is true. I mean, everything I've told you is true, the best I know how, except covering stories. I did go to the bathroom 3 times before. When I went up there, you could see all the way to the end of the store, you know, from the front to the back, and the license agent in the back. And I saw the parole supervisor standing back and talking to a guy, and I walked up to him. They handed me a driver's license. They didn't even ask me if I could drive. I didn't take a test. I didn't even pay for it. Didn't pay for it. Now, I know that that was probably illegal. There had to be something wrong with that. I tell you what I think it was. I think it was an absolute miracle. And there was, now, you can call it anything you want to. Don't call it political connections, though. No, don't do it that. Don't do that. The only politician I knew in the state was the sheriff that used to lock me up all the time. I believe that when God's got work for you to do, the walls come down. I believe just as strongly that if I had been trying to con and manipulate that into happening, I think I'd be walking today. I believe that. 5 months after I was out, they had an election for a district committeeman in my area. I barely knew what a district committeeman was. I certainly wasn't running. And I was elected by a landslide. I didn't know how easy it is to get elected. All you got to do is miss a meeting, you know. That meant a lot to me because I was the same guy who 5 months earlier had truly wondered if I would ever have one friend on this earth. If I did, it would be one more than I honestly had. And I don't mean to be melodramatic. That's just the way it is. I truly wondered if I'd ever have a friend. Truly wondered if I would ever be trusted by anybody with anything. And here I was being asked by the members of AA in 12 cities to be their trusted servant. It meant a lot to me. Then, still does. I finished up a term as DCM not too long ago. And I'm active in service. I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been all that time. Yeah, I believe that's what it takes for this program to work, is a real commitment to active involvement. I fully believe that we have to find a way to get satisfaction and reward out of helping other people. If we don't, I don't think this program comes alive. 2 years after I was out, sitting in my house one day, and I got a phone call from the state capitol, and a man on the other end of the phone I'd met one time. He came to the prison group that I was AA sponsored for. I met him one time at that meeting. He identified himself, and he said, "Mr. Ivester, we're thinking of expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you might consider accepting a position." And I swear to God, I'd never been offered a job in my life. I don't mean a position. I'm talking about a job, unless some drunk didn't have one. And I said, "My God, man, you know who you're talking to." And he assured me I probably knew me better than you myself, and he did. And I knew that would never happen. But lo and behold, I became the first ex-con in history in my state employed in any position. And here I was employed in a supervisory position to work in rehabilitation in the correction system. And I never believed anything like that could happen. And I went to work. And that's where I've been for these many years. I've had a grand career. I started out in rehabilitation, worked for 9 years, about 7 years directly in that. And then started being pushed toward management. And I really was not interested in management. I really wanted to be in a clean sort of helper role with the guys. But some folks started to push me into management. And I saw that perhaps if I moved into a position with greater authority, I might have greater influence and be able to do some things. And so even though I had some reluctance, I agreed to move into that. And in 1970, I was appointed as superintendent of first prison that I was ever superintendent of. And for almost 20 years thereafter, that's basically what I did, was run institutions and all kinds of run every custody level except maximum and run female, youth, adult, and have had a grand career. I mean, absolutely a grand career that nobody could ever imagine how much it means. You know, once in a while, the old insecurity will sneak back in, and I'll be sitting in a meeting discussing policy or budget or whatever, and I'll get to thinking, "You reckon they know?" And about halfway expect somebody to say, "Hey, what are you doing in here? Get out of here." But it doesn't happen. I could retire any day now, but I won't. If I retired, I'd turn right around and do it for nothing the next day. So that's what I do. But I'm basically I'm a guy. That's what I do for a living. And that's a great miracle for that to happen to me, because I'm what I told you I am. I did a few things. I got some college while I was at Jackson. I did a few other things. But I'm basically who I told you I was. Who I really am, I'm just another guy. I live in the little town of Aberdeen, North Carolina. It's about the size of this hotel. It's a little old town. It ain't much of a town, but I tell you this, it's my town. That's my town. I live there. I'm a citizen of that town. I pay taxes. They don't even have to come get them. I pay early every year. I vote invariably for the wrong man. Invariably for the wrong man or woman these days. I have a home there. And it's not the Taj Mahal. It's just a regular old three-bedroom ranch like I never dreamed I'd have. That's my home. I live there. It's not a house. It truly is a home. And I have a wife in that home, a little Canadian girl that I met when I traveled up there 24 years ago. They say that folks from the South talk slow. Some people think we think slow. But I talked that little girl in the span of 1 week to leave everything that she owned. Of all things, she worked for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. She got her man. She got a. We courted for 3 years, man, and we were married in '68. You know, last July, we celebrated 21 years of continuous marriage, and I'm deeply I'm deeply grateful for that, because I was not a loving person when I came to this program. I didn't think I knew how to love, but I had the great experience with that little girl of honestly coming to love another human being. I didn't think I could do that. This program gave it to me. And when I asked her to, you know, what I learned was that love is not something you fall in or discover or get. It's something we give. Something we give. And that's what I learned was that I truly loved and cared about and wanted to care for that girl. And when I asked her to marry me, I didn't ask her to share my bed or do my laundry or run my errands. You know, I asked her to let me be her husband. And miracle of miracles, she knew I was going to be down here with all these bikini-wearing Florida people, and she hadn't even told me to behave. She hadn't even told me, and I'm not an old man. But I'm a married man. And she trusts me. She trusts me. And me, an amoral alley cat character, deserves her trust. And we've had a grand marriage. We're having more fun, more love, I think more genuine kind of joy in our marriage today than we've ever had. She got active in Al-Anon, even though she'd never seen me drunk, never seen me drink. I'd been sober 11 years when we were married. She found it awkward, but she also found that there was indeed a need for this recovery program in her life and in our family. And I believe that the family that finds recovery together tends to stay together. Not always, but more often than not. And I think it's why we have a rich marriage. We have a couple of kids, all Americans, just like yours. I have a daughter, just finished high school. She's enrolling in the local college. I have a son that's 20 years old. He's a pre-med guy. He wanted to go to Duke, but I couldn't afford it. But he's in pre-med. He's a junior now. And I can't afford that. But I can't afford not to. Because I got a son who, because of the home he grew up in and because of the fact that it wasn't a place with fighting and feuding and drunkenness and junk, I think was a contributing factor in that he became an excellent student, a truly excellent student. He was elected to the North Carolina Scholars Program when he graduated from high school. And I can't afford not to. Now, I don't really think that he or my daughter inherited any superior intelligence from us. I know not from me, and I don't even really think from his mother. I think what they had was a home that provided nourishment and support and encouragement and a peaceful kind of place to grow up. We couldn't teach him how to do that new math and stuff like that, but we could doggone well stand up and cheer when they did well. I'm grateful for that, and that's who I am. I'm basically a simple guy in a small town. I'm active in this program. I didn't used to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who goes around telling about it. I am an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of a home group, and I literally did finish the coffee duty last month, and I got a lot out of it. I probably got more out of that than I do out of going around beating my gum somewhere. I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think this program is good as long as I use it, and not another second. It's a way of life. It's not a club I belong to. It's a way of life. As long as I use it, it works, and if I quit using it, it doesn't. Well, let me close with this story. Yeah, I believe that it is a way of life, and it is something that reaches into every area of my life. And you know, for many years, I've been going around the country for a long, long time. And for many years, on planes, you know how it is. You just sort of get into chit-chat with people. And it usually doesn't mean anything. You know, who are you? Where are you from? What do you do? What do you sell? And all that kind of stuff. And for many years, people would ask me where I was going. And I'm nearly always going to A deals. And I wouldn't exactly lie. I would say... I'd sort of fog it a little bit. You know, I'd just sort of be evasive. Well, I'm going to Tampa. What for? Conference. What kind? Oh, it's about alcoholism. You know, and that sounded nice for a corrections guy. We sneakily lie, don't we? And one day it dawned on me that ain't exactly what these principles are about. That's not what anonymity is about. So I made up my mind I wasn't going to do that. So one day I was going to Fargo, North Dakota in February. Well, that's a thrill now, I tell you. I was on the way up, and we had a lot of plane trouble, and I got into Minneapolis, and there was a little gal standing in line in front of me. And so we started talking. And she was a gal that was going to apply for a job as a librarian in Fargo. And I said, well, that's really nice. She said, where are you going to Fargo? What for? Conference? What kind? I said, Alcoholics Anonymous. And, boy, she just lit up. She said, well, isn't that just great? And I said, yeah, it is. And we visited and had a good time. Got up there. She said, let's sit together. And sure enough, they had a row open. And so we took them. And we got in. She sat, but when I sat in the middle. And we really were having a great time. And then just before we took off, there was a sort of frantic-looking red-haired woman coming down the aisle. And sure enough, came and sat right by me. Introduced herself. Her name was Kit. She was a school psychologist from Providence, Rhode Island. And so we talked a minute, said, before you go in. She had a tough deal. She was going to Fargo. Her family were there, and she'd just lost her husband to a very difficult death with brain cancer, and she was going there for grief. And so we talked a minute. She said, where are you going? Fargo, what for? Conference, what kind? I said, Alcoholics Anonymous. And she looked like she'd been hit by 220. You know, she said, are you in recovery? And I said, you better believe it. She said, me too, 7 years. And, oh, my God. Well, you know how we are. We don't mean to be rude to people, but I just immediately turned to her, and we started having a closed meeting, sort of closed. And it didn't really dawn on me, like I almost Fargo, that I really was being rude to a little girl. And so I turned around and apologized, and she stopped me. She said, please don't apologize. She said, what I didn't tell you was that I was to be married last week. And I went down to the church, and my husband just never showed up. And I was crushed and humiliated and so deeply embarrassed that I thought my life was over. And I was trying to find a place that I could go and just hide away and see if there was any hope for me to get a new life. Listening to you guys, God, is there ever hope for me? And I was, you know, how many times on how many planes and how many places have I hidden behind that furtive kind of notion that I can't tell anybody and have denied myself a marvelous growth experience and a marvelous blessing? That's not what this program's about. Anonymity doesn't mean to hide away and don't tell anybody. It's about a spiritual condition. And I believe, like Dr. Bob said, it's as much a violation to selfishly disclose my identity as it is to egotistically reveal it. What I found is a program that gives me a new lease on life and a new way to live, a way that I can live free and happy and most of the time, and with great bursts of gusto, and probably most important of all, with a great sense of useful purpose. And whoever you are, wherever you come from, whatever you bring here, I wish for you that and the very, very best. Thanks.